From the heart of Big Ten country, Los Angeles, California, Ryan Abraham and David Woods present the Podcast of Champions.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Podcast of Champions. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com, the USC site on the 24/7 Sports Network. And together we make the Podcast of Champions, talking all things Big Ten football. And we got football coming up, and we're continuing our team season previews. We're going to do three teams today. And we're bringing our friend back, Bill Bender, who was on the very first Big Ten version of the show, where David had some audio playing in the beginning, which he just did it again. Maybe just as an homage to the last time we had Bill on. But he's going to talk about, hold on to your seats, Northwestern and Purdue. But you can follow him on Twitter at BillBender92. He's with the Sporting News. Does a great job there. Welcome him back. The only two-time guest on the Podcast of Champions Big Ten version. Bill, how you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on.
So we've got a couple of, obviously, really exciting contenders to talk about today, Bill. Where do you want to get started? What are you champing at the bit right now? Which one of these two, obviously, steamrollers in the world of college football do you want to start with?
Well, I would submit this. I think the job that David Braun did last year at Northwestern, given what happened with Pat Fitzgerald in the summer, you have a coach resigned, however you want to put it, and he's tasked to do this while his wife is pregnant. He's a first-year defensive coordinator. For them to win eight games last year, especially how they looked in the opener, they looked awful in the opener against Rutgers, and then they turn it up and win a bunch of games. So we had him in the Coach of the Year discussions last year. Mm-hmm. And for as much was talked about Dion and, Kalen DeBoer, who won it for us, Braun was in those discussions up until the last minute.
Yeah, he ended up winning Big Ten Coach of the Year. Impressive to go from – they were 1-11. Like, this was atrocious. Wait, hold on. Do we have the – I don't know if we have it. Oh, let me see. Crap, now I got to get
the – it's a well-oiled machine.
This is – I haven't had to pull this up for a while. Here we go.
Herocious.
Yeah, they were herocious last year. That's a word we've made up, Bill. and to go, win eight games, win a bowl game, beat Utah in the bowl game – with all the turmoil and stuff that was going on, the Athletic did an actually interesting story on Braun and his kind of, rising up. He was with North Dakota State. Matt Entz, who's now the linebacker coach at USC that I've been covering for a little while, he was like his first, he coached him in college and all this stuff. And he was this very motivational player, motivational coach now, and just thrust into this head coaching role. To win eight games, it is pretty remarkable what he's been able to do. Scheduled a lot tougher this year, but what he did last year was very impressive.
Yeah, and this is a program that has been to the Big Ten Championship game twice since 2018, and Pat Fitzgerald had done a great job of building stability. And, for you guys out there on the West Coast, you could do all the Stanford comparisons all you want. I don't think they've reached the peak of Stanford with, Andrew Luck and Toby Gerhart and Heisman contenders, things like that. And they do have the stereotype of being a smart school. But I think this is a program that's also situated in the Chicago market. They've upgraded their facilities. Ryan Field, if you're not familiar, it's grass, right? And we make the joke in Big Ten country when Ohio State goes there or Michigan goes there that they let that grass grow a little bit. I think it's one of the more fun spots in the Big Ten because of that. You might play a noon game there and it's not exactly full sometimes. So I think they've done a great job of upgrading their facilities, upgrading their program. The Pat Fitzgerald scandal notwithstanding, I think David Braun has done a great job with the momentum with the program.
I'm glad you brought up Stanford as the comparison, because this is something that's really interesting to me about Northwestern and something I truly don't understand, because Stanford at its peak with Harbaugh and Shaw, they were recruiting at a top 15 level. That's the kind of hidden thing about Stanford, is that because of its cachet and academics, plus what they were able to build as far as the football brand, they recruited like an elite power. Northwestern does not. Northwestern recruits, at a G5 level. How have they been able to have any success in the last 20 years? The extent to which Pat Fitzgerald, but also David Braun last year, it's like so many of these other, I guess, Big Ten West teams where it feels like black magic at some level. But how are they able to win so many games?
I think they recruit the right defensive players, you know, not guys that are, like you said, five-star recruits, but they started to elevate that a little bit. I think they recruit, they do well out of the portal. You know, they get their quarterbacks out of the portal the last couple years. And, you know, I've always thought their defense does a good job of keeping things in front, you know, not giving up big plays, being a tough out at home. And that some of that was reflected in Pat Fitzgerald, who obviously was a long time, I mean, for those that remember, a great linebacker at the college level. I think David Braun comes from, I'm starting to trust the guys that come from the FCS powerhouses. You saw it with Leopold at Kansas, mm-hmm. Chris Kleeman at Kansas State. Well, Braun was at North Dakota State. So he knows how to win. And I think he knows how to win in this Midwest part of the country. So I think that's something to keep in mind with him. And he knows defense. And that's where it starts with a program like Northwestern.
Let's look at the schedule. We'll move on to Purdue in a second, but significantly more difficult. That, you know, they're a Big Ten West team. I think they played Penn State last year, but this year, if we pull up the schedule, you do have this team called Ohio State. I think they're pretty good. You have Michigan. You know, the Washington game is in there. Wisconsin again. I mean, playing Duke out of conference. Iowa, there's a bunch of really good teams on the schedule. I think a lot harder than what we saw last year, in my opinion. But what are your thoughts on the schedule and what they can do to try to, you know, can't finish second in the you know, division again, but what can they do against a much tougher schedule this year?
Well, it actually looks remarkably like their usual Big Ten West schedule with having Illinois on there, Purdue, Iowa, Wisconsin. So they're used to that. I mean, Michigan, Ohio State will not be easy, obviously. And then you get into that Washington game. You know, one of the things I said before they came on, no USC, no UCLA. So no California trip on the schedule. And I think that's something to keep in mind with this program as they try. You know, it's not going to be easy to replicate eight wins. But that schedule, with the exception of maybe the Ohio State-Michigan game, there are a lot of winnable games on there. They've played Iowa and Wisconsin tough in the past. They can go in and make those teams uncomfortable because they all know each other. They've been doing this for years.
I had one last one on Northwestern before we get over to Purdue. They brought in, you alluded to it, another transfer quarterback, Mike Wright, who's bounced around quite a bit. He actually went to a high school that I used to work at in Georgia. He was a prep QB at Woodward Academy. What are they expecting out of him? Because he's kind of a dual threat. He's a running quarterback. What have you seen out of what David Braun said about him, and anything you've gleaned about, you know, what kind of impact they're expecting from him? Will he change their offense at all?
Well, I mean, averaged 5 yards per carry, 24 touchdowns, 14 interceptions at Mississippi State, which was a pass all the time offense. I think they've got to trust the pieces around him. Cam Porter's played a lot of football, graduate transfer running back. AJ Henning, you know, he was a playmaker in spots at Michigan. So it's a different style quarterback. They've had guys like Helinski and Brendan Sullivan, who's at Iowa now. And like I said, they're kind of playing portal roulette is what I call it. You know, every year you turn that portal, you spin the wheel, and sometimes it doesn't work, sometimes it does. I think there's an exciting option here. And if he picks up the offense pretty quickly, and you never know how that works with first-year transfer quarterbacks, he could be a problem.
So we got Northwestern, I think, you know, can build on last year, super surprise team, the way they were come back, and see where they can build on. Purdue certainly has to build on another second-year head coach. You got Ryan Walters there now, I think 4-8 last season, so certainly some struggles. Overall thoughts on the Purdue Boilermakers going into this new-look Big Ten conference?
Well, they allow any team that allows more than 30 points per game, that's what you look at first. You still got to be able to make stops. They're switching their uniforms up to the Joe Tiller era, an homage to that. And I mean, those are the Purdue teams I remember at their best. And I'm trying to come up with a Pac-12 comparison over the years. I've always thought Purdue was good when they do things a little bit differently. And they obviously, they've had a history of really good quarterbacks at the controls of that offense. You know, everybody knows who Drew Brees is, but this is also a program that produce Kyle Orton, produce guys like Brandon Kirsch. You know, there are others that put up big numbers in that offense. And so that leads me to Hudson Card. No, second year transfer. I always believe you get the best out of that transfer quarterback in the second year. He made some plays, had some turnovers, but you know, for Ryan Walters, who's also in his second year, I think that continuity at the most important position will help.
With Purdue, obviously they had Jeff Brohm doing, I mean, probably the best since Joe Tiller, I would say. And certainly that 2021 season was, you know, probably pretty close to the peak for modern Purdue football. How much did that kind of sting that program and that fan base? I mean, obviously he was going back to his alma mater, but losing a head coach that they'd invested quite a bit in. I think he was getting paid something like $6 million a year. What were the feelings around that? And what do you get the sense of Purdue's kind of commitment to being, you know, maybe not a contender in the Big Ten, but a serious football program that's trying to win?
Right. Well, I mean, it worked both ways. I mean, a guy like Brohm, you can't fault him for going back to Louisville. And right. I mean, I challenge anybody to find a coach who took Purdue to a conference championship game, then took Louisville to a conference championship game in back-to-back seasons. And I'm not talking about basketball. I'm talking about football. It was pretty incredible what Jeff Brohm has been able to do. That said, Ryan Walters, he came in, he had a really good rep from what he did at Illinois on the defensive side of the ball. So, and you saw it late last season. I mean, they had the Michigan loss, which was very highly publicized because that was in the middle of the cheating scandal. And Walters had some pointed comments about Michigan. After that, they won two of their last three. So they did close the season with a little bit of momentum. It is bad news. And you alluded to that. I mean, they play four top 10 teams. They play Notre Dame. They're renewing that rivalry. They play Ohio State. They play Penn State. They play Oregon. I mean, as far as Big Ten teams go, they have the toughest schedule just on that alone. When a 30-year schedule is teams ranked in the top 10, and you have Oregon State on top of that, I mean, it's just not an easy schedule for Purdue this year.
Yeah, it doesn't look easy. I put it up on the screen there, that away game. You know, we've covered Oregon State, Washington State for a while, but just going – and playing in Corvallis, I mean, you, Dave and I both know that is not an easy place to go. Even if you have a good team, if you have a questionable team, that could be tough. But this, I mean, 4-8, they were in the Big Ten West last year, still finished near the bottom. I think it's getting, this is one of those teams that gets a lot tougher for going into the non-division era of Big Ten football. I don't know. Could they, I mean, can you see this team being bowl eligible with the amount of, the firepower on the schedule right now?
It's going to be really hard. I mean, we have them near the bottom of the Big Ten with Indiana. And Indiana's obviously had a coaching change with Kirk Cignetti. I think it'll be difficult to get past four wins. But again, how do we judge these teams now? One of the things with the 18-team conference is 5-7 actually pretty good? And just yeah. – They may reevaluate how they schedule their non-con. You mentioned that Oregon State game. That stuck out to me, too, when I was evaluating their schedule. I know Notre Dame's going to be hard. That is an in-state rivalry that doesn't get played enough. That's always going to be hard for Purdue. But adding that Oregon State game, most of these schools are going to look into playing one Power Four school and then two Group of Five schools. It's what I would do as an athletic director when I know I got to play nine conference games.
This we joked last time you were on about Rutgers having, you know, between 20 and 30 people on the scheduling committee for the Big Ten. Purdue must have a bunch of people who hate Purdue. Right. How do you end up with Oregon, Ohio State, and Penn State? I don't know that there are too many teams that actually have to play three of the top four this year.
Well, and it's a fact that Purdue – and Florida are the only two teams in the Power Four that by the AP poll have four top 10 teams on the schedule.
Good God.
Florida's schedule is much harder, by the way. They have an absolutely brutal schedule. And when you look at the Big Ten schedules, you know, several teams are playing three top 10 teams. It's inevitable, whether you're Illinois, Michigan, Ohio State, Michigan State, USC. But none are playing four. So Purdue adding that on the schedule, adding Notre Dame, and a very good Notre Dame team, by the way. Yeah, like you said, I don't know who they made angry in that office.
Yeah. I mean, just looking at it, you're like, I mean, it would be just Big Ten-wise, it would be tough. And now you add like, oh, you're playing Oregon coming in, like the toughest new addition. Oh, you're going to play Oregon State, who's going to be like a hornet's nest there. Like, they're just so upset at the world. Like, any Power 5 team comes into Corvallis, they're going to be fired up for that one. So, man, that's the work cut out for the Boilermakers there and Ryan Walters. One thing I wanted to mention, I forgot to mention about Northwestern. Ryan Field is going to be under construction for the next 2 years. So they're playing at Martin Field or Martin Stadium, which is like, it looks like where you play lacrosse or something like that for a couple years. Maybe one, I don't know if they're playing one at Wrigley or they were going to do some of that kind of stuff, but that might be interesting too. I mean, I went to Corvallis when they had half a stadium, 2 years ago? And that was really freaking loud. Like, they almost beat Caleb Williams during Heisman year. They were really fired up for that one. I don't know if you're going to get the same thing with Northwestern, but maybe you get a little bit of an advantage being like a smaller place.
Well, they are playing at Wrigley against Ohio State. So the novelty of that hasn't worn off. I know Ohio State fans are excited about that one to have that opportunity. Kirk Ferentz at Big Ten Media Day with Iowa, he was of the opinion that would be fine if that's a one-time thing. You know what I mean? As the visiting school there. So, yeah, they're going to have to definitely make the adjustment to that for the next couple years. But when this new facility, and all indications are, it looks really cool. It's going to be interesting to see how that works out.
Yeah.
So in other news, I think you're working on your ranking 1 through 134. And I've got a question about this, Bill. because, all right, rank in the top 25 – you know, that's kind of a fun exercise. Ranking the bottom 10, fun exercise. How do you rank 70 through 100? Like,
Well, I'm sure, though, I always make the joke, and I'm picking on Florida International a little bit. I will inevitably get a tweet that, how could you have Florida International? Let me see where I have them. I have them 116. How could you have them 116? I've lost all respect for you, and it's really... I think it almost, in doing this over the years, and I do bowl projections too and all those things, you almost have to separately do the power schools and the group of five schools. And I'm a group of five alum. I'm a MAC guy, went to Ohio University, very proud of that. But it's changed and the gaps have changed. And I think we have like three or four group of five schools in the top 40. It's really hard to do that. You know, schools like Memphis and Boise that are going to get some attention, which leads to a greater debate about their place in this new college football world. But I have I have a spreadsheet. I take it off preseason polls, take it off our preseason projections. I just, you know, one thing I was just talking to my editor about this. I'm trying to have fun this season. I'm trying not to get bogged down in the work and trying to appreciate and have fun. I know it's a busy time, but I really, if believe it or not, I'm not sick. I enjoy doing that.
I can imagine that being a fun assignment to tackle.
Who's your highest group of five team? Because this year, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of like casual college football fans that are going to be walking in. If you followed it all offseason, you know. But like, wait, why is a group of five team in there? If they were ranked 20th, why are they in the 12 seed? And wait, why is Utah, they were ranked 15th, why are they the number 4 seed? There's going to be a lot of that, I think, when this goes on. But who's your highest group of five?
Memphis at 30. And Boise State is like right – Boise State's 31. So there you go. Those are the two most likely schools, I think, to get a playoff berth. And something I think we may have touched on last time I was on is that two questions I have for this upcoming season are, one, that people are going to – especially in SEC and Big Ten, when you're fighting for that third or fourth playoff berth and the group of five schools taking it, and then we watch a game like Oregon Liberty last year where it was 45-6. I think if that happens a couple years, we're going to be wondering, why are they in this playoff?
Yeah.
That debate's coming. And then the other one is, and we touched on it earlier, the strength of schedule debate is going to get wild this year because of these imbalanced schedules from conference to conference. And I'll pose one to you guys just for fun that the committee may encounter. Let's say Florida goes 9-3 against a schedule where they play 8 ranked opponents and 4 top 10 teams. And Iowa goes 10-2, then who do they take? Are they going to honor strength of schedule, or are they going to what we both? I think the three of us already know. Are they just going to take the 10-2 team?
They've it's just always been the number of losses mattered. Like that's like all that
except
mattered.
Except for Florida State last year.
That's true. Yeah. So I think you could get it. Iowa's schedule is pretty easy compared to Florida.
Yeah, it's a whole different universe. It's a great hypothetical. The problem is it's a hypothetical that it requires Billy Napier winning 9 games, which, that's a tough one.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, some of these schools have to do that. And then there are 4 schools. I sent this to my editor this morning. There are 4 schools that are playing 1 ranked opponent this year, as of now, and that opponent is ranked outside the top 10. So you mentioned Rutgers. That's one. Pitt, Cincinnati, and Kansas.
Oh. Yeah.
So we are going – these are the schools that are going to get the treatment, I was calling it, like Kansas in November. They really haven't played – you know, favorite phrase.
Right.
They haven't played anybody. They're going to get that treatment. So I do think schedule imbalance, particularly in the Big Ten and the SEC, is going to be a very hot topic throughout the season.
Yeah, and there was no easy way to do it, I think, but just having gone through all these previews, I mean, there are a couple of teams who have supremely easy schedules, and there are a couple of teams that have supremely hard schedules, and then, you know, 10 or 12 in the middle. But it's, the Big Ten is, they might have to continue to tweak that formula going forward.
Since we're a Big Ten podcast, Bill, I know you mentioned beforehand, before we let you go, that you had got a screening of the Connor Stallions documentary coming up on Sign Stealer on Netflix? Mm-hmm. If you want to give some thoughts or whatever. Yeah, I know you can't give away stuff, but like
it's interesting and it's fair. I would say that it's going to make people mad because that's what we do. The timing's perfect because it's right before the season. And as somebody that's been around the Michigan-Ohio State rivalry forever. I made the comment this morning on another show that I hate the Connor Stallion scandal. I hate it because I love that rivalry. I love being not a part of it, but somebody that's been able to cover it for years. And, you know, there were stories about Woody and Bo in the 70s and the paranoia that Woody thought Bo was filming their practice from an Ohio State dorm. And now that it's actually happened, I hate it because, you know, the sign stealing part, it's going to make you think though, like you're going to think, cause they obviously try to present a case for Stallions as this like savant and all that kind of stuff. But what is the gray? What do you guys define as a gray area versus breaking the rule? And that's really the question the documentary poses. And I think most of the time, we're already have our minds made up, right? He cheated or he didn't cheat, depending on what team you're rooting for. And this one walks that line pretty well.
He was on the sidelines, though, for that Michigan State Central Michigan game, right? Like he was there, like in Central Michigan gear or whatever, right?
Well, that's the one with me that, I mean, I've said that one all along. I know, you know, that was a popular Halloween costume up here in Columbus.
Sure.
It really was. And, yeah, we all have two eyes. That's what I said. And you know, the fact that you guys have been to games where they know everybody that comes in those buildings. I have to, like, flash a credential. You have to sign something. You know, the process of getting in a press box, let alone getting on the sideline has to be, you know. So definitely some – there. I would say if I had to sum up this documentary in like, 2 sentences is – the serious part about the cheating and the allegations is very interesting, and that does get into some absurd things in it where you're like, that is absurd. But I think we were all saying that last fall.
Yeah. Is there who would be more upset, do you think? Ohio State fans or Michigan fans?
Oh, they're both going to be upset. Okay. I think, which is the best part.
Like, yeah, I think that means it's a good one if they're both upset. Yeah.
Yeah, when you leave, it's like anything else in life. If you make everybody mad or you make everybody happy, I think this one's going to make everybody mad, which, you know, like I said, having a chance to screen it was a lot of fun.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. We really appreciate you coming on and sharing some knowledge with Northwestern and Purdue, two could be interesting teams. Purdue's schedule just alone, and then Northwestern just from trying to get an encore of what you did last season. So should be good stuff.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. Let's do this again soon, and happy week 0, guys. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks so much, Bill. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come right back and talk a little Michigan State football. Back in a second. All right, David, we are back. I'm going to pull up our guest here. Do you want to opine a little bit on what we learned from Bill? Great to have him on again.
I'm not wholly convinced that Northwestern and Purdue are teams that will continue to succeed in the new Big Ten. I mean, Bill did his best job explaining it to me. I still don't really understand how Northwestern is ever good. Like, that was unclear to me. It remains unclear to me. I'm gonna assume it's black magic still. Purdue, I get it a little bit more, but didn't they have a sinkhole in an end zone like relatively recently? Didn't that happen? Did I imagine that?
Maybe.
So there's, you know, there's some weird things with those two programs. They currently have a combined over under win total of 10 for next year. 5.5 for Northwestern, 4.5 for Purdue. Looking at those schedules, I think I'd hit the under on both of them. But yeah.
I think I would agree with you on that one. We'll do our picks, I think, probably next week for the whole conference. But we wanted to bring in Stephen Brooks. He's covering Michigan State, covering the Spartans here for 24/7 Sports. Thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate you waiting a minute or two.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me, guys. Happy to be here.
So, Stephen, obviously completely normal previous offseason for Michigan State and then a very, very normal season entirely. How was it covering such a boring program that had nothing going on last year?
Man, it was a trip. I'm never going to forget sitting with a buddy, met up with a friend at around midnight after game two. They had beat Richmond. And it's like midnight, 12:15, around there. So I look at my phone, I get an ESPN alert and says Mel Tucker is under investigation for sexual harassment, I believe was a terminology at the time. So anyway, it hit me after that day, and then the next day they had a press conference, and things just moved quick. You kind of knew, like, oh, man. And then the USA Today story dropped a little bit after that, like within an hour of that first alert, at least how I digested it all. But then the USA Today story made it very clear, like, okay, this is going to be we're going to move into a new era pretty quickly here. And then they said they had the press conference next day. Tucker was suspended. You knew where it was going. And so for like two and a half weeks there, it was very frantic and very unusual, very weird in a lot of ways. But then once you got into, like, you know, once he had actually been fired, like into October and into November, it was kind of just like, okay, you know, like, can we just move this along here? Like, the season was going nowhere, clearly. You know, they had a long losing streak. They weren't competitive in some games. Like, there was no end goal for them to reach. They were just spiraling the drain slowly, you know. So that part wasn't very fun at all, because it's like the football doesn't even really matter at that point. It's just like, who's gonna stay? Is this guy happy? Is he having a good time or whatever, you know? And obviously coaching search stuff, but on the field it wasn't very fun at all, because you just knew, like, this is gonna end in a bad place, and there was gonna be no real carryover to whatever was next.
It's amazing when you think about Mel Tucker was the highest paid coach, you know, in college football. And, you know, we covered him, I guess, for 1 year when he was out here, when we were doing the Pac-12, you know, the Colorado's coach, and then go out and bring another Pac-12 coach in Jonathan Smith, who we also covered a lot and was very successful. Some contention when he left Oregon State, and, you know, because he was he was the one that was going to lead them through this horrible thing that they've got left behind and everything. And then he takes off too. But what has it been so far with Jonathan Smith there and, trying to rebuild the Michigan State brand?
Yeah, way different in a lot of ways, you know, like, just, you know, talking about them as people, like, their personalities are way different, you know. Jonathan Smith's very low key. At his first press conference, he said something, and I don't know if he really meant for this to stick, but it definitely has stuck. Low ego, high output, as sort of like a tagline, a mantra. And I think that that's definitely played out in the, 9 months or so I've been covering him here. You know, he doesn't want to be the show, and I think Mel Tucker definitely liked being the show at certain points. Tucker was very into branding the program and himself, though. You know, don't get that twisted. It was both. He was into that stuff. I mean, Jonathan Smith just wants to, like, be in the film room coaching quarterbacks and stuff, I think, you know, and scripting up a game plan for a Saturday and that type of stuff. I mean, he's fine with us in the media. He's honest and forthcoming and everything. He doesn't give you a ton. He won't give you a long soliloquy, but he won't BS you either. And he won't do any, like, weird fake evasiveness stuff, you know, about like, hey, what'd you have for lunch, coach? You know, he'll just tell you. It doesn't have to be this weird battle and whatnot. So there's that. I do think the team culture, there's definitely different. And I've kind of struggled trying to verbalize it. But, I mean, it's just more, I think, like connected and together. I think before it was very much like trying to be like an NFL locker room where it's like come in, eat what you catch, you know, you're on your own type of thing because we're all trying to make it and therefore we all make each other better with sort of that cutthroat energy and everything. Jonathan Smith wants a guy that's going to be here for 4 and 5 years, you know, and that's really the question. I'm sure we'll probably dig deeper into this, but like, can he build, you know, he wants to basically build the same way he did at Oregon State. But as we all know, 2018, when he got to Oregon State, and 2024 are way different eras and in a lot of ways, but especially how you build programs. So can he get enough quality players to buy into sort of that team concept, to buy into development, to buy into sticking around one place for a long time and growing together as a group without them getting picked off left and right by big donor, you know, big deals and big money and all that stuff? That's the major question. I do think he's a quality coach. I do think he'll do some good things here, more good than bad, I would think. But will he win enough? Will he get them to that higher level? Will he get them into the playoff, you know, conversation regularly enough? And that's really my question, because he's got to recruit better than he did out there, and now he's got to retain in a way that he never really had to out there.
A lot of really good stuff and a lot of places to kind of jump off from what you just said. I want to start with kind of just this year's team, but I do want to get into all the NIL stuff and just where Michigan State is positioned. But with this coming year, he obviously brought Aiden Chiles over from Oregon State, former four-star quarterback, played some last year. Is he expected to be the starter? Is there still a quarterback competition of any sort? And if so, and then just kind of the offense, I know practice restrictions are crazy everywhere now. Like most people don't get much access to anything. But from what you've been able to glean with Jonathan Smith's offensive background, kind of in comparison to Mel Tucker and then Mark D'Antonio before him and before that Nick Saban, what is that giving a different feel to kind of the way the program is and the practices is, because he's more of an offensive centric guy?
Well, to your first point, Aiden Chiles is absolutely the starter. And that goes back to something I just said, like Mel Tucker would have never announced anything until the press conference of the first game, you know, and we've just seen four quarters of a guy starting. He'd be like, oh yeah, he's a starter. You know, like that, he would have never done that, even if it was crystal clear. And Jonathan Smith in spring, like I think it was the day before they started spring ball, he's like, yeah, it would be a major upset if Aiden is the starter. Like there was just no muddying the waters or anything. It was just very blunt and clear. And that was so refreshing. So that sort of ties back to what we were talking about. So he's the guy. They're paying him to be the guy. He better be the guy. They need him to be the guy. And then so they brought in a FCS transfer as his backup, because the quarterback room was depleted, zero. All scholarship players were gone by the time Jonathan Smith got into town. So he had to rebuild it all the way. And they brought in a FCS transfer named Tommy Schuster, Michigan kid, set a bunch of records, 5-year starter at North Dakota, not North Dakota State, regular North Dakota, but still pretty good career over there, and brought him in as like the veteran journeyman backup type of thing. Then two true freshmen below them. So he's the insurance, but obviously if Chiles goes down, you know, the ship's taking on water anyway, and you know, you really just gotta kind of try to survive at that point anyway. To your question, yeah, it is interesting. I think that's more of a, I don't sense a difference in practice necessarily, like with him being an offensive guy, but I do sense like the fan base is eager for something different in that regard. Because look, I don't think they're going to have any kind of banner year this year, and there's all the numbers and projections would sort of agree with that they're just kind of going to be an average, you know, 500-ish type of team. But they'll look different if they're bad or mediocre or whatever. You know, they'll be doing it differently. Offense has been a real struggle around here from the end of the Mark D'Antonio era through most of Mel Tucker, save for the 2021 season where Kenneth Walker put the whole program on his back. But offense, yeah, basically since those playoff, you know, that playoff team and that little run, offense for the most part has been a struggle. So I think people are excited to say, hey, if we're not going to be that good, let's at least be bad in a different way and maybe score 40 a couple times while we do it. I think that's kind of what I'm sensing from the fan base more than anything.
So that terrible Oregon State team that he had his first year, which I don't think Michigan State's going to be that bad. They were 2-10 that year. But it was a total rebuild. I had to kind of rebuild from the studs. But the one takeaway we had on this show, watching Jonathan Smith, even at that juncture, was you could see how well schemed the offense was. Particularly, he's a traditional offense guy. He's more of a pro style ish, you know, kind of a Mike Riley esque. His run design, like his traditional run design, is some of the best you'll see. And I think it'll be obvious even in year one what they're trying to do. And I think once he gets a few linemen and gets a running back, Michigan State fans will be pretty impressed with that offense.
Yeah. I think they will, like, in time. And it's a, you know, it is, as you say, like, it's a different flavor of offense than what we see from, you know, it's not just shotgun, four wides, five wides, up tempo, mm-hmm. same zone read. Everybody does it, you know. And I just, that stuff bugs me, because that's why I fell in love with college football, was the tapestry of the different flavors and the different systems. Now everyone's running 11 personnel and huddle and no huddle and everything. And it's just, so I love the difference of it. I mean, it's Chris Peterson stuff. At least that's my reference point with all the shifting. They were under center more than any team in the country last year. They got a fullback on the roster now they're excited about. They're going to run double tight, triple tight, all that type of stuff. So, yeah, it is a different flavor. And folks around here, there's some, you know, shared DNA, if you trace it all the way around, with the Detroit Lions, which people over here are going crazy about right now, and just some of the stuff that they do. And obviously the 49ers as well, a little bit of that. So I think it's a system that people, yeah, definitely they're going to appreciate, they're going to identify with. And I think over time, when you're talking about developing linemen for the pros, developing quarterbacks for the pros, I think maybe it can be a recruiting tool for them even.
You mentioned developing linemen. Really, pretty much Michigan State just got to rebuild that offensive line. Where's that stand? What have they done to try to bolster and get some big bodies up front?
Yeah, so for context for people, that's probably been, when you look at Michigan State and where they've kind of dropped off of, let's just say after 2017, the offensive line's pretty much been the weakest unit in the program year over year that whole time to today. You know, Kenneth Walker, they had a couple decent players on that line. They had one guy drafted in the seventh round, and he didn't stick in the league. You know, so you can get into a good debate about how much Walker covered up versus, you know, how much the offensive line maybe didn't get enough credit. But either way, let's say they had one good year in the last 6 years. It's still been a unit of weakness. The recruiting at the end of Mark D'Antonio's time had fallen off a cliff. They were bringing in a bunch of guards and trying to make them play tackle, and half those guys didn't pan out, and another handful got injured. It's just been bad. So Mel Tucker and those guys faced a really big uphill climb to where now, you know, if they were still here, this would be a year where we'd be saying, like, hey, this has got to be a performance year, because you've got three or four recruiting classes in. That's when you expect your offensive lineman to bloom. And some of those guys are still around, but they're basically – they basically lost they did lose four starters. They lost a ton of experience. They bring in the one returning starter is tackle Brandon Baldwin, who's been a serviceable player, but not much more than that. And then they bring in Tanner Miller from Oregon State, who was a all Pac-12 guy. He'll probably be their best of the five up front. So you've basically got two positions locked in there. They brought in Luke Newman, a transfer from Holy Cross in the FCS, was a three-year starter at left tackle out there, FCS All-American at Holy Cross. Obviously making a big jump, not just to FBS, but to, you know, the highest level of FBS in the Big Ten. That's a question, but they like him at left guard right now. I think he's the front runner, but how much can he, you know, what type of player is he? Is he functional? Is he a plus player for you? What is he when he makes that type of jump? Right guard's a bit of a battle, and then right tackle's probably looking like a kid named Ashton Lepo, who's a redshirt sophomore. Was kind of a project tackle, the one that the previous staff brought in, at least – we all thought he was, and now it seems like he's developed very quickly to being in the mix, you know, great prototype type of frame, but just not a guy with a lot of football to his name. So they have to replace a lot, and it's not like they're replacing a bunch of good players either. So it's a toss-up, but for me it's the number one question still about whether this offensive unit can be anything, whether they can give Childs a chance to be a guy, whether they can get the run game going, and all these other things. It all comes down to where the O-line can be. It just – decent, you know, and it's been less than that for a long time, quite honestly.
Michigan State and Wisconsin, both to a certain extent, seem to kind of fly under the radar as far as, you know, really, really good programs in the Big Ten. But, you know, looking at, you know, Michigan State's history, obviously has had sustained success for like different eras, but, you know, going back to the 50s, but then, you know, even recently with D'Antonio. What's fan base commitment is such a big part of growing a program now, and you alluded to it in your great answer about Jonathan Smith and what he's bringing to the table. But with NIL, with all those, you know, kind of different eras of fans involved and donor levels, how is Michigan State positioned in terms of resources for the recruiting game as it's currently constituted?
Yeah, it's, I think it's good, not great, but good. And also, you know, this is, I would say, a moving target, you know. And it's an interesting sort of deal because, I mean, Mel Tucker gets broomed out of there, obviously, and sort of when things were really running hot with NIL and the recruiting circles and whatnot. And now I think, yeah, I think there's the capability, I guess, is a better way to put it. I think that, I don't know these numbers or anything, but I think that, you know, essentially I think the Michigan State, the money people are sitting on a decent pot of it because I think they recognize this isn't a team that you overspend on right now this year, you know. Like I said, they brought in Aiden Childs. That was the biggest show of force in the NIL space for me. I mean, like I said, the guy did not come for free. He didn't come cheap. I can just say that much. So there is that. And so at certain positions, when there's times of need, and I mean, they lost some critical players who I think they were competitive with. Geno Vandermark, a guard, would have been a starting guard for him, ended up at Alabama. The two defense starting defensive tackles, Derek Harmon to Oregon and Simeon Barrow to Miami. And Jaden Mangum starting safety to rival Michigan. I mean, I think they were – I know in Mangum's case, they weren't the lowest bid or anything. You know, they, actually, I believe he took a pay cut to go over there, but there's other things involved. And then the D-tackles, I know they were at least somewhat competitive in some of those cases. And, you know, could they have gone to the mattresses to keep all those guys? Probably, I guess, is where I'm trying to get. Did they feel like they needed to or wanted to? Because, again, it goes back to that culture thing. He's not going to be a guy, I don't think, that brings in a $1 million, $500,000 true freshman, you know, because he wants, again, these guys to stick around in the culture, in the locker room for 3, 4, and 5 years. I think it's going to be a program where it's more used in retention once you've done something. I mean, you got to play the game, of course. You can't fully opt out of that. You got to pay ways sometimes. But I think mostly they're going to try to orient it towards established guys or, like, you know, rainy day fund plugging in need. Like if Childs were to leave early or something and they were kind of screwed at quarterback, they need to go get a guy. I think they'd have the money. So good, not, you know, they're not in the Oregon, Miami, whatever tier. They can just throw around and buy anybody. They're definitely not there. But I don't think they're like, you know, collecting pop cans or maybe that's a Midwest thing. But looking between the couch cushions and stuff for nickels and stuff, I don't think they're doing that. I think they're probably, like I said, I think they probably have more sort of spending power than they're showing right now.
So not UCLA is what you're telling me. Okay, got it.
That's what I would say, yes. That's good.
Really, that's, I think you want to be in that tier because even like USC was pretty bad and then they're actually decent now, but people are still comparing. Like you're not going to be Oregon or Miami or whatever right now. You're just not. But you need to be in like, you know, up there. And I think it seems like Michigan State is in that spot. And I'm curious because you mentioned the defensive tackles. Tough to replace, you know, two stud defensive tackles like that, especially where they're going to major programs. Yeah. Maybe if it was a year where it wasn't a coaching turnover, Michigan State does have the resources to kind of keep those guys there. But the, you know, coaching switch and all that combined with, you know, wanting to go somewhere else, maybe that's sort of the issue there. But maybe comment on that. And also, what's Michigan State going to do in the middle of the defensive line? Because that's a couple of big names to replace for this season.
Both those guys had been flirting with the portal before. And look, you got to consider the mental state for these players coming off of last season. I mean, that was no fun at all. Like, yeah. None of it, really. You come out, your coach, you know, you win two games, great, over no-name teams. You get your doors blown off by Washington. Your coach is going to get fired. You're getting embarrassed, you know, on the field, in the headlines. Like, it was no fun at all, I think. So you can understand how a 19, 20, 21-year-old kid would be like, man, what else is out there? Maybe I just want a different vibe right now. Oh, and you're going to pay me, you know, double or whatever that might be. Like, wow, I'm going to listen. So both those guys had been, you know, Barrow was in the portal and out of the portal in October when they had the little window. Once your coach gets fired, you know, they had like the, 30 days, I think. He was in and out in season. And then Harmon was in and out in the winter portal window. And then they both went in for good in the spring window. So it's not like either of them were like, whoa, where did that come from? But they were big losses. And like I said, if Michigan State was primed to win like 10 games, I think they probably could have and would have ponied up to do whatever it took to keep them. Because, I mean, those two guys, easily two of your 10 best players. to me, probably two of your five best players, especially when you're talking about that position. Yeah, so now you're starting two guys who are going to – who probably realistically should be backups on a decent team. I think they're solid, capable, big-time players, but guys you probably love as like your fourth and fifth D tackles, not your one and two, that type of thing. So that's a big unit of weakness. I talked the offensive line. The defensive line is right there with them, especially in the interior. Because you lost guys, I think Harmon and Barrow could both be all Big Ten type of players. I think they could both be NFL guys next year. The guys they replaced them with are none of those things, just quite honestly. At least they've never shown it in their career at this point. Maybe they completely come out of nowhere. But that's a major concern. Defensive end, not as much, although there's not a lot of proven talent there, but not as much. But D-tackle, I think, is a legit concern because I just don't know how deep they can go. You know, you'd love to go like five deep with quality players. I don't know if they can get to three or four with like true quality players. They're going to have to get there just by out of necessity and rotating guys in. But yeah, that would have been probably their strongest position on the team to now one of the two weakest, I would say, the interior D-line.
So this schedule, two delicious pieces of bread around a sandwich of nails. Like it's just the everything in between is just pure metal and awful things. So it's Florida Atlantic, Maryland, Prairie View, Boston College start the season. Not too bad. You know, all those are, you know, you can squint and see winnable. And then it's Ohio State, Oregon, Iowa, and Michigan in a four-game stretch, followed by then Indiana, Illinois, Purdue, Rutgers. UCLA has something similar, so I guess I kind of know, but how's the fan base approaching this schedule, and what's your kind of sense of how Michigan State's going to handle it?
I think a lot of people that want to be optimistic want to say, like, can we at least punch up and give somebody a fight in that middle four. I'm not of that belief. Just, you know, as a reporter, I think they're going to go 0-4 probably pretty decidedly. Maybe Iowa, maybe Michigan would be the two where they could have a shot. But yeah, the fan base thinks like, oh, we can show well against Iowa and then beat Michigan on the road or something. And, you know, maybe. those are not games. They're all in like basically the same tier, you know, other than Prairie View's an FCS team. But the other seven are pretty much coin flip in terms of talent and roster composition, that stuff. Those middle four are not in Michigan State's tier. So you're talking about a legitimate upset. Yeah, Iowa comes in to Michigan State, and maybe their offense still isn't figured out by then, and maybe Cade McNamara isn't what I certainly thought he'd be a great fit for them. You know, he gets hurt and things get off the tracks there. But maybe things just don't go right for them. Their defense is still going to be very good, though. But maybe that's an opportunity at homecoming game. I don't know. And then Michigan, I only give them a shot there because I do think Michigan takes a step back. They're losing enough offensive talent that they're definitely taking a step back, I would say. The defense is still going to be lights out. But the history of the rivalry tells us, you know, lesser Michigan State teams have beat better Michigan teams than we'll see this year. So that's the only reason I give them, you know, an outside puncher's chance in that one. But to me, it's 0-4 in that stretch. And then how do you come out of that? And then what I mean by that is, where's your confidence at? How do you come out up here mentally? Where's your confidence? Where's the camaraderie? But also physically, you know, are you down four or five starters? Are you beaten up on the offensive and defensive lines or whatever, you know? That's why when it's such a hard deal playing like the schedule game and saying, all right, they'll be 6-6, they'll be 7-5, they'll be 4-8, whatever it might be, because nobody can tell me how that middle section sets them up for the last section. Guys, we've all seen it. October, November collapse with teams that are like, you're better than this, but now you're on a four or five game losing streak for whatever reason. The things just go off the rails. You know, I mean, Michigan State should have been in a bowl game last year. They coughed up a game against Rutgers, coughed up a game at Iowa that they had in control, could have easily beat Minnesota on the road. You know, so there was several games with just two or three plays and they're in a bowl game. But that real life stuff happens. You drop a punt in the end zone in a monsoon at Rutgers, and now they run off 18 straight points in the fourth quarter. That stuff happens. So I can't just say like, oh, they're going to beat Indiana. Of course they're going to beat Purdue. No, maybe, you know, just football happens. So, and they're comparable enough. So that's the thing that I keep telling everybody is I just can't. There's no way of knowing, you know, how that middle section leaves you to attack the last section, because I can see a case where, hey, they play Michigan into the fourth quarter. They lose by a touchdown, and then it's, you know, they're maybe a little juiced up going into November. I could see a scenario where all those dudes like don't want don't even want to come into the building by November because they just got waxed four games in a row or something, you know, or anything in between. So that's how I read that.
The good thing, I mean, you look at the it's Ohio State, Oregon, then at least the bye going into Iowa and Michigan. Although if you get pasted by the two best teams in the conference, maybe you don't want an extra week to think about it. I don't know. Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But what, you know, should have made a bowl game last year. You mentioned that. What's kind of a reasonable expectation? Like, we saw David Braun last year take a 1-11 team and win eight games. I don't think that's, you know, super realistic, but what is for year one of Jonathan Smith, like what would be acceptable for fans? And what do you think is like a reasonable outcome for 2024?
I think it's 6-6 in a bowl game. I think that would get a thumbs up from most Michigan State fans. You know, not everybody. Some people think that that's still too low. There's some real true believers out there. I think they can push for 8 or 9 wins. And I do not see that. I think they have a cap of probably 7, maybe 8 if everything goes well and everything goes against their teammates, you know, E. coli, flat tire on the bus, all that stuff. You know, they need all that if they're going to go 8-4, I would say.
We haven't had an E. coli reference for a while. That's good.
That's good. We brought the E. coli back. Yeah.
But it's so 6-6 and get to a bowl game because it's not a high bar. It shouldn't be for this program, but it's a bar they've still missed 3 out of the last 4 years. Not one of those was COVID, but the last 2 years for sure, 4-5 and 5-4 and 8-5 and 7, they could have been in bowl games either of those years, and they probably should have been, especially last year, even when they weren't a super talented team, and obviously they were a distracted team. But those games I mentioned, you know, they're in control in the second half at Iowa, then they punt to Cooper DeJean, he runs it right back in their face, and they collapse. They were up at Rutgers big, drop a punt in the end zone for a touchdown, and like I said, Rutgers runs off 18 straight points in the fourth quarter to beat them. Minnesota was a winnable game in the fourth quarter, and they probably didn't play their best quarterback, true freshman Sam Levy, who's out of Arizona State now. And so that's even a bigger thing, you know, about last year. So those are three games easily where could have gone the other way. Then you're in a bowl game. You know, they got demolished by Penn State at the end of the year last year. But again, you're talking about that cumulative effect, that wear down physically, that mental wear down. They were not anywhere close to Penn State, but they weren't as bad as that Friday night game looked, if that makes any sense. So that's just kind of where they were at that point in the season. But anyway, to your question, I think 6-6 in a bowl game would be a lot. And I think the schedule is there because you look at those 8 winnables at the top and the bottom. You know, I think a lot of people are hoping they can figure that out and get to a bowl game. And that would be a good start, I think, in a lot of people's eyes.
Stephen Brooks does a great job covering the Michigan State Spartans. We appreciate you coming on. So many interesting. I mean, this has been good for us. I think we only have Wisconsin left. We talked to people from every other program stuff, but just there's so many nuances. And there was a comment earlier. Let me see. This was when we had Bill on, but if we're covering the Pac-12, they said Purdue is like Berkeley with fans. So like everywhere you go, like, well, this team's pretty terrible, but they still fill a stadium. Like they're still like fans are everywhere, you know? And I found that kind of interesting. And you could say, okay, Michigan State wasn't that good that year, but like there's so many good storylines. There's a lot of history there. Like there's, you know, there's just so much intrigue. I don't know. I'm very excited about this season.
Are you excited? Yeah. The indicators are low, whether it's the Vegas line, the watch list, the media poll, 16th out of 18. Like there's not one indicator that says Michigan State's going to overachieve or even be good, but they'll pack it out on August 30th. Yeah. Now, by November, different question, but they'll be there for game one. They're excited about the new era, so I'm excited to cover it because I think it is going to be very different. And I'm interested to see where they can take it and how high they can take it. That's really the question.
Sparty. My former beat writer, Dan Wyke, was a big Michigan State. He went to Michigan State and stuff. So he's works for the LA Times now. He's a Lakers beat reporter, but he was always like,
oh, yeah. Not recognizing that.
Yeah. So yeah, he used to work for me back in the day, but big Michigan State guy. So I'm sure he'll be cheering. All right. Well, Stephen, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys. Take care. Anytime you need me, I'm usually available.
All right.
Awesome. Thanks, Stephen.
Talk down the road. Good stuff. Thank you very much. Awesome. Well, that was cool. We knocked out. We have talked to 17 teams. We have one left.
We have one left.
We're supposed to do Wisconsin today. Family thing came up. Yeah.
So we'll try to knock out Wisconsin next week. So Ryan, we now have a lot to do next week because you did not do your game by game predictions over the weekend. Is that what I heard from you earlier?
I have not done them yet.
So we can't do that next week. We're gonna have to like put those up in the article because we have to preview 18 games next week.
Oh. We could do it quick. I mean, we could, like...
We have to preview 18 games next week. Have you looked at this stupid thing?
We have 18 games to preview?
All right. On Thursday, August 29th, there are 3 games. On Friday, there are 2 games. On Saturday, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 games. And on Sunday, there's a game.
Yeah, I'll be covering that one.
Yeah.
So, get this. We'll be fine. We'll do it. USC plays in Las Vegas to start the season.
Uh-huh.
And it's not even like Saturday or Friday. It's Sunday.
Uh-huh.
I'm working with this bar called Flanker at Mandalay Bay. They're all in. They're like, yeah, let's do it. We're like, let's do it. So I was going to do like a Friday meetup. You know, we were trying to do Friday meetups forever. And they're like, all right, cool. I got a bunch of RSVPs. People are coming. They're like, why don't we do like a Sunday tailgate? Because Flanker is literally on the walkway to go to Allegiant Stadium. So like the thing that says walkway to Allegiant Stadium, Flanker is right next to it. We could have a tailgate there and then people just walk to the game. I'm like, oh, that's a pretty good idea. I got over 200 RSVPs in like 3 days. And they're like, we had to stop getting RSVPs because I don't think we can fit as many. Like the room we had was like 150 and they're like, we'll see if we, and we got to 200.
It's so cute when USC fans get excited for the start of a season.
But it's Vegas. Then we're going to do a watch party on Saturday because there's a bunch of really good games on Saturday. And so I'm doing 3 events at this bar in Vegas. Like, I'm going to be a puddle. Like, it's going to be pretty nuts. But we can do it next week. We can we have one season preview and then we have to
talk to Evan about Wisconsin. So that's going to be about 20 minutes.
Okay.
Then we have to provide our season predictions that only make sense to do before we do our previews of the games.
But we can like give – so I'm going to pick every game, but then we can just say, hey, we had Purdue at this.
Sure.
You have Purdue at that. Sure. So it won't be like
– 18 things that we have to say.
Yes.
Okay. So let's say that takes 20 minutes too.
Okay.
So that's 40 minutes.
It'll probably be closer to 40, but yeah.
So let's say it takes an hour now, okay?
Okay.
Then we have to preview 18 football games. With lines and predictions and guesses and all that.
Are we going to do our picks against the spread again?
Yes.
We doing that? We're doing that thing.
Okay. Yes.
All right.
So if we do that.
Who's going to keep track of that? Because I'm tired of keeping track of those.
No, you're going to keep track of them on your whiteboard there. So we got to do that. That's probably another 45 minutes to an hour, right?
Yeah.
Then we got to do questions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We probably have a lot of questions.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is when I texted you on, what was it, Friday?
I know. Well,
and I said, hey. You want to do that this weekend so we can talk about it on Monday?
I was going to, but then
you got drunk and did golf. What?
Your guy bailed.
That's what they call it, right? Did golf?
I did golf. Your guy bailed, and I had to like scramble to get somebody.
Yeah, you scrambled this morning. You found Bill this morning.
Yeah.
What were you doing yesterday? That's what I want to know. When you could have been creating a spreadsheet of games to pick them.
I printed out the chart, so I'm going to just pick on that, so it won't take too long. I do want to go over some of the top out of conference games.
Yeah, you want to change the subject. That's what I'm hearing.
Oh, the out of conference games.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a former Pac-12 fan, there's a bunch of games that are going to matter, and there's a lot of really good ones. Now, the Big Ten schedule is very cool. Like when you're like Ohio State's going to Oregon and all that kind of stuff, all that's going to be fun. But there are some really big out of conference games that I think are going to matter that you want to look at the first couple of weeks. Starting off, I think it's a Thursday. North Carolina is going to, or maybe that's a Friday. North Carolina is going to Minnesota. No, that's a Thursday game, the 29th. So North Carolina at Minnesota. We already talked, we talked Minnesota, PJ Fleck. They're going to be a ground and pound, powerful offense. North Carolina's losing Drake May. Like that's compelling right out of the gate. And you want to get those wins over, especially ACC and Big 12 schools, because you've propped up the Big 10 to be the number 2 or number 1 conference. You can't go losing games like that. So I think that's a big one. Penn State goes to West Virginia that Saturday. And then Fresno State's going to play at Michigan. I know they lose their head coach and all that, but that's a big one. And UCLA,
who can forget about UCLA at Hawaii?
UCLA is at Hawaii. So get a first look at Deshaun Foster there. And then USC's playing LSU, which that's big because it's, the two big conferences playing each other. Whenever you have a Big Ten and SEC, you want to root. Even I know if you're a Bruin fan or whatever, you want to root for the Big Ten team. Like you got to be in SEC mode now. Like just root for your Big Ten brethren. Okay, you're not going to do that.
Look, I think you can go into the game with whatever attitude you choose. I think maximum enjoyment is found with being flexible, right? Because, okay, yeah, I'll go in with the attitude, yeah, I want USC to win. That'd be great for the league. And then they, you know, they do. And they, oh, wow, that was great for the league. But then if they start to lose and they don't look very good, then you just immediately shift gears into pure schadenfreude and be just joyous that USC is once again performing like modern USC.
Yeah, you'd rather them lose to like Nebraska than LSU. Like, you, if you're a UCLA fan, root for USC to lose, but not against, like, have them lose a bunch of Big Ten games.
Be flexible. Be flexible with your attitude. You know, start however you want, finish however you want. Just maximize your enjoyment. All right, that's all I ask of you.
All right, week two, you got. I wish this was Stanford, but it's ACC team Duke at Northwestern. So we got the nerds going at it. That's, you know, that's a big one too. Like, I mean, Northwestern won, like we talked about, just won 8 games. Those are the kind of games you're going to need to win if you're going to get back there with what I think is a little bit tougher schedule. Bill didn't think it was that much tougher. Then a bunch of good ones. Texas is at Michigan, SEC, Big Ten, freaking huge. Both playoff teams.
I think you're going to be playing running back for Texas in that game.
They've had a lot of guys hurt, so that's good for Michigan. But Michigan, obviously, a huge turnover. Iowa State at Iowa. You know, Iowa State's one of the potential favorites to win a very wide open Big 12. Iowa rebuilding their offense, that'll be big. Kansas, I mean, they're really good. They've done so well. And they're at Illinois, which, you know, we'll see. Colorado beat Nebraska last year. They're coming to Lincoln. Like, I can't see Nebraska losing that game, but they lost it last year. They're going to be really pissed off. We think Nebraska will be a lot better. And then Boise, which one of the favorites to make the playoff from the group of five, at Oregon. The Ducks have had some problems with them, punching players and things like that. But, yeah, we'll see. So, you know, some pretty big ones. But Texas and Michigan highlighting that weekend, David.
Yeah. Yeah, I think. And then, I mean, there's going to be all kinds of good stuff, and we're going to get into them as the weeks go by. But there's going to be some, I think, essential matchups in this, you know, non-conference season. What I will say is, with the 12-team playoff and seemingly nobody gives a shit about anything besides a playoff anymore, it doesn't matter as much as it used to. Like, these non-conference matchups matter, but what matters the most is that you put together a gaudy record in your conference. And if you do that, if you're a Power Four team, you have a pretty good chance of making the playoff. Like, yeah, as we just talked about, a 10-2 Iowa, even with that schedule, would have a pretty compelling case, even only playing basically Iowa State in the non-con.
I get what you're saying, but there is the potential for which one is stronger. So if, like, the SEC beats the Big Ten every out-of-conference game, if there are only a few, and then it comes down to, like, a 10-2 Iowa versus, like, a 10-2 LSU or something, like 10-2 Florida or 9-3 Florida, their schedule is, like, stacked. But if it's, like, a team that doesn't have a stacked of a schedule. LSU plays USC and UCLA and stuff, but, like, a team that has a similar not good out-of-conference schedule, and you got to pick one of them, are they going to say, well, the SEC is stronger? But if the Big Ten has a couple feathers in their cap and USC beat LSU and Michigan beat Texas, you might be taking Iowa over Ole Miss or something like that if they were to be compared. So I think it could matter getting that third, fourth, fifth team into the playoff potentially.
Yeah, I mean, but does that matter?
Well, I mean, yeah, like, it's like getting, it's going to be part of the power thing. Like, if the SEC has 5 teams in the playoffs and the Big Ten, they have 3, but they don't have 5, you know, like, I think you'd like to be a 4-4 situation, or you have the advantage, like 4-3 or something like that. But I think those, I think the out-of-conference games always matter a lot. Unfortunately for, like, Florida State, they got screwed last year because they beat LSU to start the season. Like, they had beat an SEC team that was powerful, and they were undefeated, and it didn't count. But there was that caveat of losing the quarterback.
I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
How many teams will the playoff have to expand to for USC to make the playoff?
They could make it this year, dude. Like, their schedule is very tough. Uh-huh. They could make it at a 9-3 team.
Right, could. But how many will it need to expand to before they actually win?
No, they could do it at 12. They need no more expansion than they already have.
Mm.
Why? What do you think UCLA would need?
25. No, they'd have to finish the season ranked in the top 25, which I don't believe has happened since, let's look, UCLA football seasons. Final. Okay, 2022. They were 18th. Okay. So 18 teams.
Yeah.
Yeah. The last time they finished in the top 12 was 1998.
Okay.
That was, I was when they finished the season, I was 13 years old. I am now between 60 and 80 years old.
You have aged, I think, a little bit.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it would need to expand to 18 for UCLA to have a chance.
Okay. Should we get to questions?
You want to get to questions? You want to talk questions now?
I don't know.
That's what you want to do here on this show?
We could.
Of ours? Yeah, sure. Where are we?
I think Frank.
Frank, the original? Gone but not forgotten?
Yeah.
All right.
Can we do it?
Go for it.
Gone but not forgotten. The Pac-12 is gone but not forgotten. I guess I didn't read the subject if the first line was going to be the same, but whatever. There may not be a question here. Not usually, Frank. You don't usually have questions. But I think college football is going to be surprised by the quality of the former Pac-12. I look for the, quote, chip on our shoulder, not Chip Kelly, David. I know that's a trigger word for you. Teams, by the way, if I'm reading a question, and maybe I do this too much, and then I put commentary in the middle of the question, do people get it that this is what I'm reading, and then I'm adding my own commentary, and then I go back to reading?
It's inflection. People have much better ears than you give them credit for.
No, I just do it, and I think people would get it, but maybe I was wrong. So yeah, I wanted to get your expert opinion.
Now, reading a transcript would be far different.
Yes.
Reading a transcript would be hard. But listening, no. I mean, people understand nuance.
And they understand.
They understand tone. They understand.
When I say, I look for, quote, chip on our shoulder, and I make the comment about Chip Kelly, and you're being triggered.
I mean, do they think all of this is part of the question? Probably not.
Hopefully not. Okay. I look for the chip on our shoulder teams of Washington State and Oregon State to each have 10 wins in 2024. Whoa. I think Stanford and Cal will finish at least in the middle of the ACC. Do they understand that that's sarcasm? I believe three of the four teams moving to the Big Ten and Big 12 will finish in the top half of those conferences, with one team in each conference battling for first place at some point. I don't know if I give him a job on that one. I'll hold off. No questions from Frank in Sacramento.
Okay. No, neither of Washington State or Oregon State are going to have 10 wins in 2024.
No.
Stanford and Cal will each finish in the bottom, I don't know, third of the ACC?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't even go. I would say bottom third more than bottom half.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
maybe
going
Cal.
To the Big
maybe
Ten,
Cal
Big Ten and Big 12, I think you have a much better chance of what you say here. So of the three Big Ten teams that have a chance to finish in the top half of the league, I think I would put it at Oregon has a almost a lock chance. USC has the next best chance. And then it really, really depends how you look at Washington or UCLA for that third spot.
Yeah.
Washington lost so much, but they have Jed Fish. UCLA actually returns a decent amount, but they have a first year head coach. So one of them could. I just don't know. And the Big 12, Utah and Arizona, I think, are pretty much locks to be in the top half.
I think so.
But then it's also Colorado. Do you buy what, you know, Dion and everyone is selling about that team, that they have real potential to contend or not? And then Kenny Dillingham, where is he in the rebuild? Denny Dillingham.
They got some problems. I didn't bring that up. I forgot there was a topic I wanted to bring up. Did you see Chris Cartman, our buddy? Let's do ASU Arizona real quick. Cartman tweets out, Mason Williams has retired from football, according to Kenny Dillingham. Hasn't practiced since camp. He was in the two deep at nickel. And his father, Maxell Williams, who's got had two sons at USC and then this one at Arizona, didn't retire, got stressed out by them coaches playing games with him. So that was a little little kind of interesting. And then in Arizona, we told you we'd bring you former Pac-12 teams, Newsy. They shut down media access. Did you see this?
I did not see
this. Our friend Jason Shear, who what I'm going to miss the most about the Pac-12 is Jason Shear's Twitter beefs with different people.
Are you telling me Bren Brenton is getting all crazy coach already?
Little crazy coach. Apparently, and I was reading from Shear's tweets because you got to read those because they're
just every single one of them is pure gold.
It's amazing. He was getting into it with one of the Tucson radio guys who apparently, from what they said, they asked the media don't report on injuries, and the Tucson radio guy kept doing it. And then they pull him aside and said, hey, don't do this. And he kept doing it. So they just shut down media access to everybody. So Shear was pissed. And then the radio guy was like asking for, I think they shut down the live Twitter live, unless you're a premium member. So the guy was asking for like $11 a month or something. And Shear got on him. It was pretty funny. But Arizona shut down their media access. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Anyway, a few little notes I wanted to have from former Pac-12 teams. Because I think about those. When I see the news, I write it down in our sheet, even though we don't cover those teams anymore.
Can we talk about the LA schools being super organized and great with how they let people know about practice changes and things? Because so UCLA this past week, so they had announced full on, like they had sent an email in July, and then they had tweeted out inviting fans to two open practices, August 10th and August 17th.
That's very cool.
So cool, right?
Yeah.
Autograph sessions, get people out. Then this week, they decided to close the second open practice. But did they email? No. Did they tweet? Also, no.
Really?
Did they tell us so we could just tell other people and hope that everyone heard? Yes.
Oh.
And that was the only communication. It's like, I'm not some whiz kid, right? I don't know everything. But if I use certain communication avenues to disseminate information about a thing, to then rescind that thing, I need to use those same communication platforms.
Especially because it's free. It's not like you had to like, it's going to cost us 10 grand to tell. Yeah, no.
UCLA also, like, they had originally planned to do fall camp through essentially Saturday of this week. Yeah, no way. they stopped last week, and basically, I think we were done on Friday, and they closed practices. They closed like five practices that were otherwise going to be open to the media.
Oh, so no access at all.
No access at all, like 5 days that were supposed to be.
Wow. No.
But like again, a change that was made this week.
So you have all your schedule and everything.
Yeah, it was just funny. Yeah. And then USC.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad.
No, it was actually the opposite, but also communication.
Oh, that
not a strong.
The biggest issue I have is like the late communication. Like literally Friday after I am on, because you know I don't like to go on vacation, but I'm on a boat, you know, doing a little fishing locally, just you know, out of Redondo, nothing crazy. And I get a text, hey, check your email from USC Sports Information, and email comes a few minutes later. You're thinking like, what the heck's wrong? And it's like, oh, there's gonna be a scrimmage tomorrow morning, like. In like 16 hours, there's going to be a scrimmage at the Coliseum, park on campus, walk over. You can watch, but you can't report on anything. That's worth it just to watch. Like, and we can't say anything, but it was worth to watch. But it's just a little frustrating that, like, I had Saturday plans, you know, and I changed them because I got a notice Friday afternoon that they were going to have a scrimmage in the morning. So, yes, I'd rather have some heads up, but at least it was opening something up and not taking something away.
It's beautiful. All right, we got a text message.
Ooh.
This is from Brian.
Okay.
This is for Dave. Do you think Chip will game plan and call plays for Ohio State first non-conference games like he did for UCLA? I would describe Chip's play calling as vanilla and use those games as preseason conference scrimmages. By the way, Ohio State fan, I keep trying to say Oregon State.
It's so weird.
Ohio State fans take the under and the opponent with the points in early non-conference games. I'm looking forward to a terrible offensive game for Ohio State. See 2023 ASU or 2022 U of A, two embarrassing losses by UCLA. All right, let's look at what Ohio State has on the schedule in the early going, because I think this is going to be an indicator. It's Akron, Western Michigan, and Marshall. Yeah, they're not going to do anything that interesting. But I don't think you'll be able to know. So with UCLA, the talent level, I think in 2022 is pretty good, but for the most part, way below where Ohio State typically is. So I think even if he is pretty vanilla, you're not going to be able to know against those sorts of teams. Mm. Like they're probably going to score, you know, 45 plus on each of those.
Yeah, score and points
if they,
at will. Like,
if they don't,
we could call plays and score.
If they don't, then I think you can start ringing some alarms for Ohio State fans in the Chip Kelly era. But no, you won't really know anything until they get into conference play. This is an absolute trash non-conference schedule for Ohio State.
Yeah, but I get what you're saying. They're taking a little shot at
I think Chip, with Chip,
which you don't mind.
Well, with Chip, I think Ohio State fans better get ready for, like, I think people have told them. I think Urban Meyer was quoted pretty recently saying, "Hey, whatever you think about Chip Kelly, it's not that anymore. Like, what he runs now is a play offense. It's not a system offense. Like, he's going to try to craft a perfect play, but he's not running a blur up-tempo spread scheme anymore. He's going to, like, do a bunch of different things to try to get, like, the exact perfect play," which if you have perfect players in a perfect NFL system can work, which he nearly did in 2022. If you don't have that, it's a struggle fest at times. That's what it's going to be. And you just have to count on the talent of your players being good enough that he can pull it off. Yeah. I think it might be, but it also might be a work in progress at the beginning of the season.
I think that's fair. He does. You were talking about Jonathan Smith and the ability to draw up like really good run schemes and run. I think Chip Kelly does a very good job at that too.
Yeah.
Like,
no, I mean,
his run game. I mean, he's master.
He
at doing
can
that.
Make a run game out of anything. But in his older days now, he wants to fit his pass concepts in there as well, and he wants to experiment. He wants to try different things, and you know, oh, I saw this. It's really interesting because I had occasion to read recently one of his one of his speeches or clinic speeches from when he was at Oregon, and it was all about, don't be a play offense. Don't like watch a high school game and say, ooh, I want to take that play and put it in my offense, so we're going to spend some practice time on it. Instead, work on the like 10 things you're really good at and focus on those. And it's a completely different human being now. Like, he's a completely different human.
He's doing that.
He's a play offense guy. He wants to, oh man, I saw they were doing T formation in the NFL on Sunday. I'm going to put that in on Tuesday and we're going to have fun with it. Because I think he's gotten bored with like winning and like doing that whole thing. And his main focus now,
he's got to focus on recruiting. Right?
His main focus now is like getting off whatever jollies he can, you know, bringing back something from 45 years ago.
So
this
we're going to see some wishbone.
This got negative.
You got super negative. We see it's a wishbone. They got these like top three or four wide receivers in the conference and they're like running the ball. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. That's
oh, yeah. Get ready for all your outside receivers to be excellent blockers. Yeah, I hope you enjoy your third string tight end because you'll see him a lot.
All right. We got one. Big love from Down Under. Dear Podcast of Champions team, I hope this email finds you in great spirits, filled with the same delightful banter that keeps me coming back for more. As an Australian UCLA alumnus back in Melbourne, your podcast has quickly become a highlight of my week. It's hard to get any college football talk down under, especially when we were in the Pac-12. I bet you the Pac-12 network was available in Australia. It just wasn't, not Los Angeles, but Australia.
I just love getting an international email. Right,
it's
here.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. He says, I love not just insights into the wacky world of Pac-12 football, now Big Ten, but also the kind of witty repartee that makes me feel like I'm talking with the boys. That's awesome. Thank you for saying that.
Love that.
Speaking of which, I have a burning question that's been occupying my mind lately. Dave, your takes are always a blend of wisdom and what some may even say whimsy, and I'm particularly eager to hear your thoughts on this one. Do you think UCLA will ever return to the golden era of football? My dream was a Rose Bowl for so many years. That was David's birth dream. And Now that isn't really an option, what should be a lofty goal for our boys? I've been a fan for as long as I can remember, and while the journey has had its ups and downs, my hope for a triumphant resurgence never wanes. What are your prospects for our beloved Bruins? Are we on the verge of a breakthrough now that Chip is gone, or is it a distant dream? Another question to Ryan. As a USC fan, do you think UCLA as your biggest rival? Thank you for all the laughter and insights. Keep up the great work. If you're ever in Melbourne, I'll buy you boys a beer. Kindest regards, bro member, Aussie Bruin. His name is actually Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan. That was a delightful email and very complimentary, and I loved it. And keep them coming. So what I would say, look, hope springs eternal in the human breast. UCLA still has all of the same quote unquote natural advantages it always did have. Mm. Like those don't. Now California is a little bit less of a hotbed of talent than it used to be, but we, in this state, we still have more people than every other state, and you can still field an entire football team just from an entire good football team just from in-state talent. Might be a little light in the defensive trenches, but otherwise, it'll be pretty good.
Yeah.
UCLA can, and I will still say, should be better than it is. I think there's been massive, massive missteps in leadership over the years, including recently, that have made it hard. I think some things would need to change with how UCLA operates for UCLA to ever get back to where it was in the 80s. But look, all things are possible. UCLA would have to change the way it budgets, change the way it approaches athletics. And then, you know, I mean, we'll see if Deshaun Foster works out. But assuming it goes the way that most UCLA head coaching regimes have gone recently, also hire very well and make sure that the guy you hire has some upside and isn't just some old retread. And I think if you can do all of that, I mean, recruiting at UCLA and even in an NIL era, basketball has gotten to the point now where it's probably top five in NIL. And that's not as much money, but there, and I know this is a crazy thing to say, there are a shitload more UCLA football fans than there are UCLA basketball fans. Now I would say there's a passionate bunch of UCLA basketball fans who are also very wealthy who will donate things, but it's not as if football is without wealthy fans. And I think if UCLA showed any sign of life, any pulse, and they had the, and it might be Deshaun Foster, but have the right guy in charge who can then, cultivate that, then, I mean, UCLA could be a recruiting power again too, but it's all a what if, because right now that's not what it is. And, you know, getting from here to there seems daunting. But really all it would take would be a couple of years. Like if you get the right mixture of things, it doesn't take that long, but it's getting that mixture. And, you know, that seems like it's a huge cavern at this point.
I think you're being a little too tough on them. I mean, for a basketball school, I think they've done very well, like over the last, how long have you been alive? You said 60 years. They've been pretty good. He wants to know, has Dave taken UCLA to the Natty and EA college football yet?
Yeah, I have.
Cam. Okay.
Yeah.
Cam. He's done it.
I did it. So I first, I sucked really bad. And I think I talked about this on the show. And so I was playing on varsity and that was way too easy. And I took UCLA to the Natty, I think in year one.
Okay.
Then I did it on All-American, and what I did to make it easier, because I've gotten better. Like, I'm not throwing interceptions all the time anymore. So what I did was I'd play a season, like I'd play the regular season games and then simulate the playoff and stuff, because I felt that was kind of cheating, because I'd gotten good enough on All-American that I could do that.
Okay.
So I think the next step is to try one on Heisman.
All right.
But I'll do that. I've gotten D's.
And the last part of his question, he wanted to know, so who's as a USC fan, do you think of UCLA as the biggest rival? I think USC has two big rivals. They have UCLA and Notre Dame. And I think it was John McKay that put it, well, like, there's no better feeling than beating Notre Dame, but there's no worse feeling than losing to UCLA. So the win over UCLA is not like David says, when Arizona gets to beat UCLA in basketball, it's like their Super Bowl. I mean, when UCLA beats USC, it's like their Super Bowl. It's not for USC, but it is more like the Super Bowl when you beat Notre Dame. So I think it's you'd rather beat Notre Dame. That's the best feeling and the worst feeling. You don't feel as bad losing to Notre Dame, but you feel bad losing to UCLA. You don't get the satisfaction of beating UCLA like you do with Notre Dame. That's how I would describe it. Yeah.
That seems fair.
Yeah. What do you got next?
Oxnard Steve. When an immovable offense meets an unstopping force. Boys, thanks for yet another insightful podcast of champions. Pondering the theoretical matchup of Iowa's 2023 offense versus USC's 2023 defense, I've already seen that on YouTube. I think it was played way back in 1923, back when the Hawkeyes were black and the Trojans wore darker black. The field looked like dirt with white stripes, no numbers, no logos, no ads. The fans in the stands all wore suits and hats, all of which were various shades of gray. And during the game, not one forward pass was completed. The only one that was attempted was bobbled by the Iowa receiver and subsequently dropped by the USC defender, who would have had a clear path to the end zone had he kept the ball in his hands. And not a single running play went for more than 3 yards in a cloud of dust. And amazingly, those Hawkeye ball carriers went down without a tackle being made. They either tripped over a chalk line or they had tied their shoelaces together, like those on the rack at Walmart, so they don't get stolen. Or the ball carrier simply ran into the back of their corn-fed offensive lineman and fell backwards onto the ground. And if I remember correctly, yes, the game was a two-way shutout. Iowa's offense could not tally a touchdown or field goal, and USC's defense could not score either. And not just because of the lack of scoring, but the stadium itself was very quiet. No electricity meant no PA system, no piped-in sound effects, and the yell leaders had to use megaphones for the fans in the front row to hear, "Rah, rah, sis, boom, bah!" On the bright side, with no TV timeouts or prolonged halftime studio shows, the game was mercifully over in less than 90 minutes. I am so thankful that nowadays we have distractions like checking the status of other games on our smartphones when the action on the field, or lack thereof, is less than riveting. Oh, and now we have fans get to wear colored clothing, see players wearing colored jerseys, and see them play on green grass or artificial turf under lights at night while noshing on gourmet cuisine and drinking designer. Oh, hell no. Just effing give me my beer and a hot dog. Oxnard, Steve.
Thanks, Steve. Hey, real quick, we got some breaking news. The Arizona State quarterback, but I'm just kidding. No, we have a super chat. Alan in St. Louis. West Texas Mike. NCAA 25 advice. Use a playbook with lots of RPOs and keep opposing offenses in front of you with cover 3-4. Don't get frustrated with small gains.
Yep. That's very true. And thank you for that. What I've realized in playing, so I'm in a user dynasty. So first, don't try to man tackle anyone. Like if you're playing on defense, just let the computer handle it, because so many of the big touchdowns that get ripped off are because you are trying to tackle. It's impossible to tackle in this game, and the runner just runs past you. So don't even take control of the tacklers. Don't do it. Just pick a defensive lineman and try to beat the tackle or the, you know, guard or whatever. Second, dink and dunk, man. Like, yeah, take your shot when there's a shot to be taken, but just take first downs. Just march down the field, because it's really frustrating for the other player.
Oh, yeah. All right. We got two more. We get out of here. John and Brea says, thank you. Dear Ryan and Dave, last week's podcast was one of my favorites of all time. The way you seamlessly moved from talking about Penn State and Iowa to answering questions about Big Ten defenses versus Pac-12 offenses to live broadcasting an earthquake and then talking about the Olympics encapsulated perfectly what the podcast of champions is all about. Hey, it's an earthquake, a rolling one, not a big jolt. Oh, and a bit of an aftershock. Cool. Now, which Olympic sport would you like to attend in 2028? That's why I need the podcast of champions in my life. I'm so happy you're back with renewed energy. I used to say life is too short to watch Big Ten football, but not anymore. Thanks to you, I'm adopting the Minnesota Golden Gophers as my team. And when Ryan goes on vacation to Catalina every other week, please get the Minnesota 24/7 guy to guest host. Now for the he was really good. Now for the real reason for my email. Dave, I don't remember hearing what you thought about Andor. It's one of my favorite Star Wars productions ever. What do you think of it? Thanks for putting in a perfect amount of effort on this podcast. Go Gophers, John and Brea.
So, John, we actually did talk about Andor because Ryan shared, I think on this show, that you thought it was boring.
Yeah. I wanted more lightsabers, and you're like, it didn't have lightsabers. It was great.
So, yeah, I think it's the best – it's probably the best Star Wars property Yes. I mean, can you really say it's better than the original Star Wars? Probably not. But it's of like anything that was produced since 1983, it's by far the best thing. I think it's good specifically because it doesn't have lightsabers, and it makes the universe feel big in a way that the Abrams movies didn't, in the way that, I mean, even the prequels didn't. There's so much going on in so many different areas. I love the structure of it, like just from like a storytelling standpoint, doing these like 4-episode arcs three times was, it really worked, and it helped to kind of have these culminating periods in each thing. And there's some big ideas in there. You know, it's about Star Wars crap, but it's also about other things in a way that like those Abrams movies are about nothing. They're about how do you rhyme with something that happened 30 years ago. These have theme, you know, they have something to chew on a little bit that is, you know, worthwhile in anything you're consuming. So yeah, Andor, fantastic. Can't recommend it enough. Don't watch any of the other Star Wars shit. Most of it's terrible. But Andor is really good, even if you're not into Star Wars.
Are there new, The Mandalorians or Boba Fett ones?
I didn't watch. I think I missed the last two seasons of The Mandalorian, and I missed everything but the first two episodes of Boba Fett because it was not good.
I still like those because
I didn't watch The Acolyte.
I don't know if the new ones came out.
The one before The Acolyte, whatever that one was called, or the one after it. What is the one now? That's The Acolyte. What was the one before? Ahsoka. I didn't watch that.
I didn't watch that either, yeah.
I ended up watching Obi-Wan. It wasn't very good. It was fine, but that was pretty much only because Ewan McGregor's pretty darn good. You know what I'd like to see them do? And I think it's kind of sacrilegious, but they should go this way anyway, because then they could actually have somebody do a good job on the prequels and the Abrams movies, is do a remake of Star Wars, like the original, and have Ewan McGregor play, like, I think he's probably about the age of Alec Guinness now.
Oh, they were saying that, like, have it.
Yeah, he's about that age now anyway. So just do a remake of Star Wars in, like, 5 years.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. What the hell? Why not? Get a new Luke. And then you can redo, basically memory hole the Abrams movies and just redo that whole thing with, like, you know, characters who are, like, properly aged. And then you don't have this stupid thing where you just recreate the circumstances of the beginning of, you know, episode 4 for whatever, episode 8 or 7 or whatever it was. Yeah. Anyway, more Star Wars for you.
I think we got one last question.
Is this from Jake from What's Brewing?
Yeah, it is.
Woods post-game compilation from early in the Chip Kelly era. Have you downloaded this thing yet?
I did.
Okay.
I don't know what's in it. I just downloaded it.
Be advised, I will not be offended at all if this doesn't make the show emails. However, fellas, I was going through the What's Bruin sound archives heading into this historic Big Ten season, and I stumbled on this compilation I made of Woods doing the post-game broadcast during the 2016 season. This was the year that Jim Mora, previously we were very happy with him, he went into 2016 having changed offensive coordinators to Kennedy Polamalu, and it was a disaster.
Yeah.
This was Josh Rosen's sophomore season, in which they ditched the perfectly fine but overly simple end zone offense for the horribly Byzantine and terribly bad offense of Kennedy Polamalu. God help UCLA fans if Bieniemy's offense is anything like that. Woods picks up after the most painful loss to Stanford ever. Stanford scores 2 TDs in the final 24 seconds, which I watched while sitting in my apartment in Atlanta, Georgia. And carries all the way through the final back-to-back losses to USC and Cal, with UCLA favorite Mike Falefel at quarterback for the back half of the season. This is certainly emblematic of the passion of UCLA fans and the reason why for the past 2 decades. So enjoy.
Okay, so this is a mashup he made.
A mashup of my post-game broadcasts from 2016.
And he did this, like, when did he do this?
Back then, I'm sure.
Okay, so.
Yeah, it was a painful time.
Okay, let's play it.
I'm your host, David Woods. We're doing a post-game broadcast. Really, UCLA was a lot worse than I thought. It's not a great way to start off the year. UCLA just lost in just gruesome, awful fashion to Stanford. mere moments after UCLA lost 23-20 to ASU. That was just dreadful offensive football. This was really, really hard to watch first half. UCLA lost again tonight to Washington State. Receivers once again dropped balls. I'm coming to you mere seconds after UCLA's most recent riveting loss. This one, the unwatchable game against Colorado. The offense was not good, putting kids to bed after that riveting wild game that UCLA lost again. I'd say probably the most unwatchable half of football that I can remember. I'm coming to you immediately after UCLA's 36-14 loss to USC. This one's going to be bad. Pretty brutal loss.
Well, that was a game that happened and mercifully ended after a while.
I got to use that one again. That was a game that happened and mercifully ended after a while.
Yeah. Unwatchable came up more than once. Yeah. You have a theme sort of when you're kind of going into
this. Yeah, I sure do.
That's pretty good stuff. That was from Jake, right?
Yes, it was.
Jake does a great job over there. He's not one you hate, right? You don't have a feud with him or anything?
I don't have a feud with no, what's brewing? That's Jake, that's Mike as well, and Bill. I know them.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Mike works for you guys, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's like a do you ever go on their podcast or not really?
I have not been. No.
Really?
No.
They is that because they don't want you on, or would you just say no all the time? Or
I'm a I wouldn't say I'm a busy person, but like whether I, you know this, whether I respond to an email right. or not is like a real open question.
Yes.
Particularly as it pertains to my future schedule, because yeah. who can know? Who right. can know whether I'll be available at
even
that
though
time?
We're teamed up and like doing a show together.
Correct.
Like, could you not respond to me? Sure. Like,
yeah. Know. There have been times where we haven't recorded a show simply because I never responded to Ryan. So other shows, like the best chance like a radio person has of getting me on air is if they call me or text me like literally the morning of.
Yeah.
Like, okay,
come on later.
I can right. probably get on there in an hour.
Yeah.
But 2 days from now? 2 days from now, I'm a whole different person, right? Like, how many cells do I lose in 2 days? I'll be a completely different person.
That's
by then.
True. Okay. Well, that's going to wrap it up.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is that it?
I think we're done. Yeah.
Oh, no. Earl and Torrance has a question.
Where?
Will there be a suicide poll this year?
Oh.
Matthew.
Yeah.
Matthew.
We didn't hear back from Matthew.
Where's Matthew? We've got another Matthew in here, but we don't have the right Matthew. Sorry, Matthew. But we need the other Matthew.
Yeah.
Matthew.
I don't know. We'll see. Matthew did the different Matthew said this is a podcast that happened and mercifully ended at some point, which I think is a great way for us to go out.
Beautiful.
For David Woods, I am Ryan Abraham. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. That's an hour and 38 minutes of your life you're never going to get back. And we will talk to you next time.
Goodbye.